domain of study. But we've been studying arguments for the existence of God. That's the first element of a defense of biblical Christianity. We first believe and acknowledge and recognize and support that God exists. That's a part of this study. The second part of that defense of Christianity is that the Bible is God's word, that it's from Him. And then we can be sure, if we believe God to be honest and to be capable of preserving His word and all of the things that go into it, God Himself being infinite, we believe that if the Bible teaches some particular thing, that thing must be true, that teaching must be true, and is therefore reasonable and rational for us to put our faith in whatever that conclusion is. But we've so far been studying just the first proposition. We're not far from being done with that, and maybe you're glad of that, but that's where we are. So God exists. But in summary of these arguments, I want to run through just a couple of, and I've tried to condense these down in the simplest form that we can present them. I want to run through a couple of statements that are related to what we've said, again, in condensed form. We're not looking at the details and the specific arguments and the setups and so forth. Just a summary of what we said as we've gone through these two arguments. In the case of the cosmological argument, you remember the word cosmos has to do with order or being. And cosmological arguments typically start out with a question, why is there something rather than nothing? That really is the most basic way to remember and think about the cosmological argument. Sometimes I remember it by thinking about the first part of the word there, cause. We look for a cause or explanation for the universe around us. So we might say, first of all, that effects have causes. Effects always have cause, and there are no known exceptions to that. Every effect that we observe has a cause. You can imagine walking around in the woods and seeing a tree, and you recognize then that that tree must have been caused by something. There must have, in years gone by, must have been a seed that fell in that very spot, which led to the presence of the tree. So effects have causes, therefore the universe, being an effect, you might say, has to have been caused. Secondly, things that begin to exist were caused. That is, anything that at one point does not exist and then later does exist must have an explanation, must have a cause that brought it into existence. That was another form that we took of the cosmological argument. If it begins to exist, it must have been caused. Third, when we talk about the nature of the cause, what must the cause look like? We noted that it has to be outside of the universe. That is, if something within the universe was causing the universe, well, we have to explain that thing that was in the universe. So we're not capturing all of the universe. All of the physical universe is what we're studying as an effect. So whatever caused that effect must have been outside of the universe. Well, if it's outside of the universe, it could not be physical in nature. It could not be based on time, because time is a part of the universe. So it must have been outside of the universe, and it must itself have been uncaused. If it was itself caused, then we'd need to find another cause for that cause. So the cause must have been outside of the universe. Also, we said the cause has to be big. It has to be at least as big as the universe. Anything less than the size of the universe in magnitude and intensity and strength could not have caused the universe. Think about the things that are within your power to cause or my power to cause. Those things are always smaller than myself. And so causes must be adequate, must be big enough. Causes must come before. They must be antecedent. That is, they exist before the effect that they bring about. And we looked at these things in detail. The last point here that I want to make has some opinion in it, admittedly. Okay, this is my opinion. This is my sort of commentary on the situation in the world around us, but I think you might agree with it. We should notice, as we think about the atheist response to the cosmological argument, some desperation. There is what looks like and can only be desperation as they go about trying to explain how the universe came from literally nothing, how the universe caused its own beginning, they might say, or was caused by some, and the words are even almost silly, quantum fluctuation in a vacuum or something like this. Things that we don't understand that we try to get to do a lot of work in our philosophies. The self-beginning of the universe from literally nothing is a reflection, I think, of desperation, of a deep desperation. Think about the position that the atheist finds him or herself in. And I would almost hate to attribute being an atheist to a woman, because women are wonderful. But there are men and women atheists, of course. Think about the desperation that's going on in the following. The atheist says every effect has an adequate cause as they go about doing their science, whatever that may be. As they study the world and the universe and so forth, every effect must have been caused. Except for what? Except for the universe itself. Except for everything you can see, everything we can imagine, that itself was in some way uncaused. There's desperation inherent in that view. So that's a summary of the cosmological argument. Do you have any questions or comments about that? Any thoughts you'd like to make before we move on? Someone has something in mind they'd like to say. You can almost feel it, can't you, Seth? Any questions or thoughts? Okay. The second collection of arguments we looked at were the teleological arguments, and these are based on design. Teleos has to do with order and structure and design, arrangement of objects to bring about and accomplish some purpose or some design. So a summary of the teleological arguments would look like this. We started out by noticing that order and design are opposites of randomness. So what happens whenever things randomly take on their eventual ends? If we let this building be devoid of any activity, if no one came in the building, no one cleaned the building, no one took care of it in any way, what would it look like in 20 years? That's the sort of thing we need to have in mind when we think about randomness. The opposite of randomness is order and design. There is purpose. There is functional complexity going on. There is structure and so forth. That is the opposite of randomness. But then we said that those kinds of things do not occur spontaneously. I think it was Arnie who said weeks ago that if you think about what happens in an explosion, you think about some large bomb going off. Arnie was thinking about the Big Bang, which we imagine or envision as an explosion. Think about the consequences of that sort of energy. What kind of structure, what kind of design or order come about when something explodes in an uncontrolled way? Order and design do not occur spontaneously. The next thing we observed is that the natural tendency, and we've already said this really, but the natural tendency is toward disorder and randomness. And this is evident to us in every area of life. In fact, in our own lives, we see that if we aren't careful to maintain structure and order, that randomness, disorder, decay, and so forth will come about. Even if we try to maintain order and design and so forth, entropy and disorder and rust and ruin and these things are something of a natural tendency. There's a natural tendency in the universe toward disorder, okay, that has to be fought against. This applies to our cars, applies to our bodies, applies to everything that we interact with. The natural tendency is to disorder. But then we said, what do we observe in the universe? In the fourth place here, we noticed the fine-tuning of the physical laws. The universe is full of constants and tunings that have been manifested in gravitational forces we looked at, and electromagnetic forces, and other forces, fundamental forces that govern the motion of atoms. which affect everything from the cellular processes in our bodies to the motion of the stars and the planets. All of these laws are finely tuned in such a way that scientists can imagine that if they were different, even by the smallest amount, life itself would be impossible. A solar system would be impossible, and so forth. So these physical laws are finely tuned and designed. That's not my term, but that's a term that's in common use in the scientific community, is fine-tuning, or the anthropomorphic principle of the physical laws. Number five is the arrangement of the solar system. That was a mind-boggling arrangement as we studied how the sun is at the center and by its gravitation holds the Earth in its orbit. If the Earth were further away, things would be too cold. If we were closer, we would be too hot. We're right where we imagine we need to be. But even at the position that we're at, we're subject to dangerous particles coming from the sun at high energy. The Earth just happens to have a magnetic field that filters those particles and sends them out around us so that life is possible. The Earth is covered in water, and we went on and on talking about some of the details. We described our planet is in what's called a Goldilocks zone, and by that we mean it's not too hot, not too cold. Things are just right for the existence of life on our planet. We talked about the complexity of a single cell and the design that's inherent there, how every aspect of the cell has to be coordinated in such a way that there is no damaging byproduct of one chemical reaction that would ruin some other function of the cell. Everything has to be coordinated, and that is a tremendous amount of complexity. But then we go from the single cell to a more complex organism, even say like an earthworm or a small animal, up to and including our bodies themselves. The complexity there is truly staggering. And then the question in the background always, always is, what's the best explanation for that complexity? How do you explain the design or the apparent design? If there is design, there must have been a designer. A watch demands a watchmaker. A building demands an engineer. It takes a programmer to make a functioning computer program. It takes an author to write a book, and so forth. And so this fundamental principle applies to the organization of life itself, not to mention the solar system and these other things. But again, we take a minute and look at the atheistic camp. What is on the other side of the argument? Well, for one thing, and there are other issues, of course, but for one thing, the atheist is desperate in their disregard of the first and second laws of thermodynamics. And we looked at these in some detail. The first law of thermodynamics demands, and there's no known, it's only a law because there are no known exceptions, it demands that matter and energy are never, ever, ever, ever created or destroyed. It never happens, except for the universe. And the second law, all things tend toward disorder and decay. This is a scientific formulation of what we know when we leave our car parked for 6 months and it doesn't want to start. Tendency toward disorder and disorganization is captured by the second law of thermodynamics. That applies. There are no known exceptions. Every physical system left to its own will decay, will go to a state of homogeneity, to randomness, and to less structure rather than more structure. Except for life, except for in the universe, as we see life and perceive the complexity of life. And so there is an inherent desperation here that's present. Okay, questions or thoughts before we move on there? So we have a summary of cosmological, teleological arguments. Questions or thoughts? How long would I have to wait till somebody made a comment? Yes, sir. If that were true, I'd be very happy. But other questions or comments, thoughts, anybody?
You used the word staggering. I like that word. Mind-boggling. The first chapter of the book of Romans,
are without excuse. Mm-hmm. And all of this complexity leads to that end. They are without excuse. Yeah. Nothing else.
Yeah.
Complexity of design. I'm sitting here thinking about the fundamental laws of physics and nature, some of the things that you've mentioned, and some of the points that you brought up in terms of the same laws that govern both motion and activity and limitations of activity in with regard to a planet or a galaxy.
Yeah.
Govern the activity at the cellular level. We can't suspend the laws. We can't overcome them, and yet within the complexity of all of these laws, build in pieces that allow us to accommodate doing 100 million kinds of things. The law of gravity.
Mm-hmm.
Things fall, mm-hmm. And yet within these laws are allowances by way of other laws and pieces of other laws that allow us to build an airplane or a rocket ship.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's sad. Just that one is big. And then the deeper we look, the more mind-boggling it becomes.
Yes.
Without excuses, this is the presence.
Truly, truly. Yeah. Yeah. When you hear the phrase, they are without excuse, doesn't that frighten you a little bit, though?
Yes. Think about that. Think about an infidel or an unbeliever standing at the judgment and trying to explain, in light of all he has seen and experienced his whole life, to explain why I am wrong. Mm-hmm. Here's my excuse, and this is acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't.
Very good. Very good. Thank you, Seth. The other questions are, yes, sir. The internet? Well, we know God's in control, and we know that only He knows the end, and He knows how it will end, and only He knows.
They closed the observatory in New Mexico. Did you hear about that? Because they were watching something, and it spooked them. They don't know what it is. There was a whole bunch of stuff about that, too. I guess the post office were closed and everything.
Oh, wow. No, I did not hear about that. I did not hear about it.
That's been around a couple, 3 weeks
now. So what Seth said is, I think, an excellent segue into where we want to go next, at least for a couple of minutes, which is, what's the value of this? I feel a little bit guilty that I've spent the last couple of weeks talking about science. That just feels strange to me in a Bible class to be talking about things that have to do with how the human body works, for example. I believe it's a valid thing to do. I think it's part of understanding God's power and God's design, and we remember that God is responsible for all of those things. But we have to bring this back to a practical value. What's the purpose of this, and what good does it serve us? Of course, the first answer to that question is that it is healthy for our faith. To recognize who God is, how powerful He is, what He has done, that He is the one who designed us. And by the way, if He designed us, He knows us better than we know ourselves. And that's unquestionably true. But a second answer to that question is that we can help other people. We can help those around us. And I'd like to jump into this for just a few minutes. A practical view of a study like this is that we can help other souls. We can help other people that we encounter, our neighbors, friends, those we work with, and so forth. those we spend enough time around that we enter into conversations about more than just trivial things. A starting point here is that we should remember that there are some people out there, and this is important to remember, that there are some people out there who, in the world, that we encounter, who would believe, but who don't believe for a couple of specific reasons. They would like to believe sometimes, but they don't for a couple of reasons. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 4 talks about those whose minds the God of this age has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel, the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. And so there is a blinding effort going on the part of Satan, according to that passage, that blocks their belief, blocks their ability to believe, whatever you want to say, who would believe, who would otherwise believe. I want to look at a couple of reasons why people don't believe. Why sometimes we don't believe. Why sometimes we are tempted to not believe. And let's not put this on the other. Let's apply it to ourselves as well. Sometimes we don't believe because we stubbornly reject moral responsibility. In my mind, this is particularly true in certain classes of people, certain people who consider themselves elite, who are more subject maybe than the rest of us to pride and arrogance, whatever the case may be, but we sometimes reject moral responsibility. And one way to get out of moral responsibility, maybe the only way to get out of moral responsibility, is to deny the existence of God. Because if there is a God, there is an objective moral standard. And so by rejecting God, we're able to, we think, reject moral responsibility. That's at least one reason for rejecting and for not believing. Is there anything we can do? Is there anything we can do to help someone who is in that camp? Well, maybe not, but maybe so. And so that's something to think about. Another reason some people fail to believe, reject the truth of God's word and so forth, is that they fail to question established views. They fail to question established views, in particular in the realm of science. Some people do this out of laziness. Okay, laziness is very common, as you know. And so they fail to take on any question just because they don't exert the effort. We don't exert the effort to question when we could. We could do that, but we don't because of laziness. Sometimes we fail to question the established view because we've been so indoctrinated that we're not even aware of it. And I think that is the case for a lot of people. We are so indoctrinated as we go through training and so forth that we get to a point where it seems impossible that, for example, as Rick mentioned in his prayer, that the theory of evolution could be false. Everyone around us, everyone in our experience, say, believes the theory to be true, and so we've become indoctrinated, and there's a large cost to escaping, a large challenge to escaping that indoctrination. Another reason why we fail to question, I think, is fear. I think a lot of times we are afraid of questioning because we're afraid of what we will learn if we do question. And this one I think is very real. We're afraid that if we do study, if we do pay attention to scientific discoveries and this sort of thing, that something will be discovered, or maybe something has already been discovered, that will repudiate or cause us to question our faith make rejecting our faith the more rational thing to do and the more reasonable thing to do. We are sometimes afraid, and I think that's something we should recognize. Also, pressure, we've talked about this in the past. A lot of people don't believe because of pressure from various quarters. Sometimes it's academic pressure. Sometimes we're afraid of what would happen to our jobs if we did question, or what would happen to our status, how accepted we are or are not, and so forth. Okay, what is stopping those around us from believing in the truth of God's word, in the truth of, in particular, his existence and creation. When I think about the last point there, and I don't want to spend much time thinking about this. We're on the wrong slide there. Apologize for that. We were on the wrong slide. As I think about the pressure that exists, I recall a student who came to me at a place I worked one time, and he wanted to do some analysis of a biological hypothesis. So his hypothesis was very simple. Okay, don't think it's that complicated. His hypothesis was that blood pressure goes up and peaks at some point in the middle of the day, and then drops off, and then the next day goes up and peaks somewhere around the middle of the day, and then drops off, and that there's this daily cycle of blood pressure. He was doing something very closely related to blood pressure. So it goes up and down. That's all he was, that was his hypothesis. And his professor, his biology professor, told him to come to me and I would help him with the analysis. And so when he came by, I was more than happy to talk to him, and we worked went on to work on the project. What he did was he took some of his friends, which is not a good idea, but he took some of his friends and asked them to record their blood pressure throughout the day for a couple of weeks, and they did that. And so he had data points that he wanted to try to fit to a sinusoidal curve, just a curve that goes up and down like this. And I was more than happy to do it. I was excited about it. I thought it was interesting, until he told me why he was doing it and why the biology professor had suggested this problem, which was, she believed that it was true that in the middle of the day, our ancestors, by which I mean ancient, not even ancient, that word fails, millions of years ago ancestors who were hunting needed their blood pressure to be higher in the middle of the day so that they could better attack and spear animals on the plains of wherever they lived. And this was her hypothesis, and she had a student that she wanted to test the hypothesis. That is, that maybe some of that has persisted to this day, where blood pressure goes up and down, and that's mirroring what was the case millions of years ago when our ancestors were hunting and needed the blood pressure to be higher for the time of hunting. Whatever you think about that hypothesis, whatever I think about that hypothesis, imagine the pressure that this student was in, because he described all of this to me. He explained it to me, this evolutionary hypothesis. And I said to him, I will help you with the analysis, but I will tell you the hypothesis is invalid and it's wrong. And the whole assumption, the evolutionary underpinnings, are wrong. And I talked to the professor about it as well, and I told her that it's wrong. And we had an extensive discussion. Guess what? this fellow was an athlete, a very nice guy. He considered himself to be a Christian who believes in God, who believes that God created the heavens and the earth. And I came to know this after we talked for a long period of time. He believes in God. He believes that evolution is a false theory. He attended a campus Bible study regularly and wore a cross around his neck, and, you know, just whatever that means. But he believed in God in some sense. But here he was, desperate to get recognition from this biology professor, desperate to do some project with her and to have something to present at a conference and this sort of thing. And completely unable to defend himself against the pressure that he was subject to. What could he do? What could he do? He was in a position of great inequity there, you might say, in an academic perspective. And so I tell you that story to help us recognize, hopefully to help us recognize, the pressure that is inherent, in particular for students. Now, I want to say more about that, but I want to also point out that the same sort of pressure that a student feels toward a teacher, that faculty member feels in her community of scholars. Does that make sense? She feels pressure too, and I think Andy made a comment about this a week or two ago, that if she rejects or even hints that there's a question in her mind about the certainty, the utter certainty of the theory, say, of evolution and other such theories, she will be ostracized, she will be rejected, she will not be able to publish anything, very likely. And so there will be a lot for her to deal with, let's say, okay? And so there is enormous pressure. She could even lose her job, certainly lose status, and so forth. And so the pressure that that student felt, I want to say almost everybody feels, okay? Almost everybody feels. And that's artificial. It's not truth-seeking. It is an artificial pressure that's imposed for other reasons. Okay. One other thing I'd like to say about that before we move on is if you have students, if you have children, grandchildren who are heading off to the university, to a university somewhere, I hope you will be careful to present to them as best you can at least evidence that points them in the right direction. Students are heading off and all too often get into classes where there is, again, this pressure that exists on many levels, and they flounder. They suffer tremendously from it. The only way to combat that is to prepare them in advance. Prepare them before they go, support them, and remind them that the truth is not fragile. And so that's where we want to go next. So as we think about a practical view, how can we help people? There are some wrong responses for us to take as we study and encounter the evidence and look to it. The first wrong response, again, is fear, and we've already talked about this a little bit. We are afraid, I think, of what we might find. But the truth is not fragile. The truth will not be injured by investigating it. As a matter of fact, the truth is unquestionably on our side. As I think about scientific discovery throughout time, if it was ever appropriate to believe that the physical universe demands a designer, that the complexity of the physical universe demands an orderer and someone, a god, to give it structure, that has only become more true as the generations have passed. As time has gone on and further discoveries are made, the truth that is established is that complexity is more than we ever thought it was. It's greater than we ever thought it was. And so if it was ever appropriate to believe that there was a designer, that some physical reality demanded a designer, then it's become more the case with passing generations as we learn more. The truth is not fragile. Augustine of Hippo said, "The truth is like a lion. You don't have to defend it. Let it loose. It will defend itself." And I recognize that we are defending the truth, and we are tasked with defending the truth. But the point that's being made here is the truth is the truth. And so we shouldn't be afraid of questioning it or studying it. Another wrong response is anger. Anger, and I lump this together with condescension. We should not just get angry at individual who disagrees with us. We should certainly not ever condescend or be cruel or harsh in an unnecessary way. Now, I recognize that this is a natural response given what we perceive to be and what I believe to be the consequences of atheistic worldviews. For example, atheism leads us to relativism, which is the philosophy that basically Anything that you believe to be correct, as long as you deeply believe it, is correct for you, and that is your own truth. Atheism has led to, well, the theory of evolution, which is based on the notion of survival of the fittest, which we'll talk more about, but that leads to a lack of respect for life. So if you believe survival of the fittest is a foundational principle of life, and that that is how life came to be, that cannot but lead to a lack of respect for life across from young to old and anywhere in between. There is an inherent lack of respect for life that comes about as a consequence of atheism. But that doesn't mean it's appropriate for us, for me or you, to get angry or to condescend whenever we encounter someone who is, say, an atheist or an evolutionist. Jude chapter 1, verses 22 and 23, "And on some have compassion, making a distinction, but others save with fear, pulling them out of the fire, hating even the garment defiled by the flesh." When I think about that last phrase there, in this context, it reminds me of the notion of abortion and how the lives of unborn babies are brutally taken away from them. That causes me to hate something about being a part of the race, to hate even, you might say, the garment defiled by the flesh. But Jude says, on some have compassion, others save with fear, pulling them out of the fire. And so this is the responsibility of the Christian. So those are wrong responses. What can I do, though, if I'm talking with my neighbor? We have maybe 5 minutes left here. And so let's take a look at a couple of questions. And I'd like you, if you have suggestions, to add to these. These are basic questions that I can ask someone who is questioning or thinking about atheism, evolution, in conversation. So first of all, if the universe had a beginning, what caused it? And then you can close your mouth and let the question sit for a minute. That's an honest question. It's a valid question. I can ask that question of anyone who is interested in some discussion about origins. If the universe had a beginning, what caused it? What caused it? Did it cause itself, or did something else cause it? That's a valid question and deserves to be pondered. If the universe had a cause, what was it? What energy caused the Big Bang? So if all things demand causes and the Big Bang is an effect, what energy was shoved into the Big Bang to cause its enormous consequences? Another question, and this is Arnie's question, does unbridled energy, unbridled, explosive, catastrophic energy ever produce order? Can you give any example of that happening? Do you believe the universe is uncaused? That is, that it has no cause whatsoever. Number 6, could the order in the universe be the result of randomness? Is that possible? Can random processes, atoms bouncing off of each other, result in the order that we see around us? Here's another question. This is one of my favorites. Is there anything that cannot be explained by random processes? It's mind-boggling to me that the evolutionist is in the position that every physical reality, let's say in the realm of life, every reality in the realm of life can be explained by random processes. It has to be. There can be no exception. Any reality discovered or yet undiscovered has to be explained by randomness. There's nothing so complex in the universe that it can't be explained by randomness. Number 8, does functional complexity ever arise from disorder? In other words, really this is related to number 9, does information, functional information that accomplishes something, does that ever arise spontaneously? Has a book ever written itself? That's to some extent, as Andy points out to us often, all analogies break down. But there is something to the analogy of a book writing itself when we think about the nature of DNA. Okay, we have just a couple of minutes left. I want us to get us started in the next direction, which is a study of evolution. And I'd like to take a week or two to dive into this so that we could feel like we have some understanding of what the theory says, why it works, something of its history, and so forth. In my mind, the theory of evolution, again, this is an opinion, is the atheist's answer to teleology. That is, there is design and order in the universe. How do you explain it? In particular, there is design and order in the realm of life, And so how do you explain that order and arrangement? I think the perspective that we need on the theory of evolution goes all the way back to the beginning. And it's amazing to me how many Bible classes and sermons begin with an appeal to Genesis 1 or Genesis 2. And that has to be appropriate. I'm sure it's appropriate. But for perspective, we need to go back to Adam and Eve and ask the question, could Adam and Eve possibly have rejected the existence of God? Is that possible? Is it possible that Adam and Eve could have denied the existence of God? The answer is definitely no, isn't it? It would have been impossible. Okay, we'll pick up with that next time and begin our study of evolution. Thank you for your attention.